It's Wednesday, June 14, 2017. I'm Albert Moeller, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Is your rabbi a Democrat or your Baptist pastor a Republican? It turns out that's probably not an accident. And of course, when we consider these things at the level of worldview analysis, we can understand the reason why. But the New York Times found it this week very, very interesting. The headline in the story, your rabbi, probably a Democrat, your Baptist pastor, probably a Republican, your priest, who knows? Kevin Quayle is the author of the article. He says this, America's pastors, the men and women a majority of Americans look to for help in finding meaning and purpose in their lives, are even more politically divided than the rest of us, according to a new data set representing the largest compilation of American religious leaders ever assembled, end quote. Now, that's quite a statement, the largest compilation of American religious leaders ever assembled. It turns out in context, what that actually refers to is probably the largest research base for any kind of study that takes as its concern the relationship between denominational identity and clergy and political affiliation. Quayle continues, quote, like their congregants, religious leaders have sharply divided themselves along political lines. Leaders and congregants of Unitarian and African Methodist Episcopal churches are overwhelmingly Democratic, as are those of Reform and Conservative Jewish synagogues. Those of several Evangelical and Baptist churches are overwhelmingly Republican. If religious denominations were states, according to this report, almost all of them would be considered either safely Democratic or safely Republican, with relatively few swing states, end quote. Now, once again, what we're confronting here is the radical polarization of American society. What many in the media find most interesting is the political polarization. And, of course, that shows up over and over again. The disappearing middle is a big story. It's a legitimate story. But behind that is another kind of polarization, and that is America's theological polarization. It turns out, and, of course, we shouldn't be surprised here, there is an almost direct linkage that is even now recognized by the researchers who conducted this study and also by the New York Times who are reporting on it. What we find rather stunning in this article is the one-to-one equation that is basically made here. The argument is, if you actually know the denominational identity of a minister, you also probably know two things. That is, the political affiliation of that minister and also the political identity of the congregation that is served. Now, listeners to The Briefing understand we've gone over this material before, but this is a new angle. What we've looked at over and over again is the fact that theology always has consequences, and theology is determinative of worldview. Worldview inevitably leads to policy positions and political philosophy. So we understand the linkage here, but now the New York Times clearly is concerned about this very reality. Furthermore, there's a sense of shock in this article, a shock that the pattern would be so clear, and furthermore, the predictability would be so virtually absolute. Some sociologists have referred to what's happening in the United States as the big sort. That is, Americans are increasingly sorting themselves out politically, economically, sociologically, religiously, of course, and even in terms of residentially, where they choose to live. One of the most interesting things in American life is that neighborhoods tend to be rather politically alike. That is to say, within the neighborhood, neighbors tend to agree. They tend to sort themselves out even in terms of the neighborhoods in which they choose to live. The researchers behind this study, Eton Hirsch at Yale and Gabrielle Molina at Harvard, they, according to the New York Times, identified about 180,000 clergy, and they were able to match as many as 130,000 to their voter registration records. Now, that's a very significant research sample. If you're talking about clergy in the United States, and you're in the numbers of 180,000, you're really looking at a massive sample. And the researchers are very clear about what's happening here. It's another evidence of the big sort. Mark Chavez, a professor of sociology, religion, and divinity at Duke University's Divinity School, said, quote, it's a reflection of the ongoing sorting we have in American life. Why would we think that religion is immune to that? End quote. Now, anytime you see a media report like this, and someone who's a specialist such as Professor Chavez is quoted, you have to realize he may well have said a good deal more than is included in the article. But that one statement that is included, he seems to be saying that we shouldn't be surprised that religion isn't immune to the sorting, that theology somehow matters. But that's where Christians have to turn around and say, actually, that's more fundamental than any other form of sorting. It is that theology is prior to and foundational to anything that follows, including the politics. Now, that raises a huge question, and even the researchers seem to understand the importance of the question. Which direction does this pattern go? Does the theology determine the politics, or does the politics determine the theology? Now, at this point, we could look at it sociologically, try to find some way to measure that. But in terms of Christian biblical worldview analysis, we're really led to understand that the theology has to be foundational. Not because it's just the first order issue that people consider, but because eventually that theological identity will supersede everything else. Now, two denominations are kind of chosen by the New York Times as illustrative of what's going on here. They are the Episcopalians and the Methodists, in particular the United Methodists in the United States. Now, judged from an evangelical perspective, the interesting thing here is that even though there are some evangelicals still inside the Episcopal Church, there are some evangelicals certainly within the Methodist Church, both of those denominations are overwhelmingly represented by theological liberalism. And so you're talking about two relatively liberal Protestant denominations in the United States, and both of them are overwhelmingly Democratic, but not equally so. The Episcopalians, as the authors in here indicate, something like the state of Hawaii, tend to be disproportionately overwhelmingly Democratic. In this sense, the Episcopal clergy are also disproportionately liberal even compared to the United Methodist clergy, and it shows up in the membership as well. As the researchers behind this study indicate, on issues such as same-sex marriage, it turns out that the Episcopalians are far more likely to affirm same-sex marriage than the Methodists. As Kevin Quayle reports, quote, Episcopalians were much more likely than Methodists to express support for issues like gay marriage, immigration, and abortion rights. Across denominations, he continues, the researchers found that the political affiliation of a congregation's leader was a stronger predictor of the congregation's policy views than the political affiliation of the congregation as a whole, end quote. Of interest to me, the secular researchers behind this study seem to be scratching their heads at the reason why the worldview of the pastor is even more determinative of the policy positions of the congregation than the political affiliation of the congregants themselves. I think the easy answer to that, at least, should be this. Leaders are called to an even higher standard of consistency and thoughtfulness on these issues. Thus, we shouldn't be surprised that both on the left and the right, theologically and politically, the leaders are more carefully and consistently defined even than their congregants or followers. You'll recall that the headline in this New York Times story referred not only to pastors, but also to rabbis and to priests. And you'll remember the odd way the headline communicated the distinctions. Rabbis are overwhelmingly Democratic. Pastors are more likely to be Republican, and you'll recall that the headline said, in terms of Catholic priest, who knows? What's behind that? Well, American Judaism is extremely liberal, both theologically and politically, but especially politically. As a matter of fact, the Jewish vote is one of the most predictably liberal votes in America. And what about the Catholics? Well, it turns out the Catholics are increasingly, although also largely historically split over many of these lines. Republican, Democratic, liberal, conservative, the Catholics are far harder to predict on these issues. But the headline really does define the pattern. When you meet a rabbi, almost assuredly, politically and theologically liberal. When you meet a Baptist pastor, almost predictably, theologically and politically conservative, by no accident. And when you're dealing with a Catholic priest, well, at that point, you better ask some questions. But here's the clear issue of predictability. When you do ask those questions, you're going to discover that the theological and the political convictions are tied together. And of course, you understand it's by no accident. Next, when we look at America and we take the map of the United States and consider which cities and which regions are most secular and those others, that are most religious, especially in terms of Christian identity. Well, it turns out a new study indicates something of the fact that the picture is a little more complicated than we thought. Not so much that the alternatives between deep areas of belief and deep areas of secularity don't exist, but because the historical story is a little more interesting. For example, the Barna study recently came out with a study differentiating between major American cities, labeling them in terms of a range of those that are churched, unchurched, dechurched, and post-Christian. So you're not just talking about churched and unchurched, you're looking at some very interesting distinctions here. For instance, there's a difference between unchurched and dechurched. Unchurched perhaps would mean never actually churched. Dechurched means, oh, it was churched, but people who had been going to church are no longer going. And then, of course, there's post-Christian, regions of the country that are now so pervasively secular that even a Christian memory is receding further and further into the background. Now, we already know this even before turning to the Barna research. We know that there are regions in the United States that help to tell the story. If you look at the American Northeast, what was previously known as colonial America, you're looking at the first region in the United States not only to become American, but also to be evangelized and congregationalized. The American Northeast was the very birthplace of Christianity in the United States, in particular, English-speaking Protestant Christianity. But then you also look at another region in contrast. That would be the American Pacific Northwest. What makes it different than the Northeast? Well, for one thing, the Northwest was never really evangelized or congregationalized. One of the interesting things to note about the Pacific Northwest is that the majority of its population centers didn't really even exist when the two Great Awakenings became so much a part of defining American religious life. In this sense, you might think of the American Pacific Northwest much as you would think of Australia. It certainly is a continuation of the culture moving westward, but as is the case in Australia, the Pacific Northwest is still pervasively secular, but it never was really pervasively churched. The great church-going regions of the United States, at least over the last century, have been three. First of all, in the upper Midwest, where immigrant Protestant groups and Catholics dominated. Just think of cities such as Chicago or Minneapolis and St. Paul. But then secondly, the American South, the so-called Bible Belt, where institutional Christianity, and specifically evangelical Christianity, took hold and helped to define the culture from the very beginning. The third area of deep church-going in the United States is the so-called Sun Belt, especially looking at Southern California. Just take, for example, Orange County, California, all the major churches that developed there and in the larger Los Angeles area, and then move eastward through Arizona, New Mexico, into Texas. And in that area, very strong patterns of church-going, including both evangelicals and Roman Catholics. But big changes have been taking place in the United States. The Pacific Northwest had been the most secular region of the United States. It would be classified in the never fully evangelized category. But it's very sad to note that it's now the American Northeast, the very cradle of Christianity in the United States, that's now the most secular region, the area where there is the lowest rate of church participation and where any register of theistic belief comes in at the very bottom. Barna's research that was released just a few days ago is focused on DMAs, or designated market areas. That's something of a replacement for the old SMSA, or Standard Metropolitan Statistical Area. Those are census defined. But we're talking about major cities. We recognize them by name, but they include not only the city center, but also the connected suburbs. Now, according to the Barna data, the most churched areas in the United States, the most churched DMAs or cities, are Chattanooga, Tennessee, and Salt Lake City, Utah. Now, here you'll note, there's no theological definition here. We're talking about religious identity and participation. So in Chattanooga, Tennessee, it's overwhelmingly evangelical Christian. When you're talking about Salt Lake City, Utah, well, to state the obvious, it's overwhelmingly Mormon. But it's still interesting to note the levels of intensity. But in terms of the unchurched cities, at the very top are San Francisco, Oakland, and San Jose, California, at about 60% unchurched. Other cities that made the top 10 list in terms of unchurched include both Reno and Las Vegas in Nevada, Springfield and Boston in Massachusetts, Manchester, New Hampshire. Well, it turns out those cities are all in the top 10 list of the unchurched. When it comes to the dechurched, well, San Francisco, Oakland, San Jose appears right there. Now, that was on the unchurched list, too. How did it get on the dechurched list? Because an awful lot of the population there in that region is made up of people who once attended church or whose family once attended church, but they do so no longer. Other cities in the top 10 of the dechurched include Seattle, Tacoma in Washington, and Portland, Auburn in the state of Maine. Now, the last of these categories, post-Christian, indicates the part of the population and the regions in which they live that are most distant, even in terms of memory, from historic Christianity. As the Barna organization identifies, quote, to qualify as post-Christian, individuals must meet 9 or more of our 16 criteria, which identify a lack of Christian identity, belief, and practice. These factors include whether individuals identify as atheist, have never made a commitment to Jesus, have not attended church in the last year, or have not read the Bible in the last week, end quote. Now, in the list of the top 10 post-Christian areas, metropolitan areas in the United States, you're looking at Portland, Maine showing up in the very high list, along with Boston and Manchester, also Albany and Schenectady and Troy, that area of New York State, Providence, Rhode Island, Bedford, Massachusetts, and Burlington, Vermont. So as evangelical, gospel-minded Christians here in the United States, thinking about our own country as a mission field, it's important that we recognize that metropolitan area by metropolitan area, city by city, we're not looking at exactly the same challenge. We're looking at that sorting that takes place in America, now coming down to which cities are most and which are least secular. But I think the most interesting dimension of this research is to remind us that there are different ways of being secular. There are the unchurched areas, there are the dechurched areas, and then also there are post-Christian communities and cities. Now, you'll notice there was an overlap of some of these cities and metropolitan areas in these lists, and we can understand that too. These metropolitan areas don't always represent just one of these patterns. But what does this mean for gospel-minded Christians? It means that we need to understand the enormity of the challenge we face in the United States. Now, just at the level of what we discussed in the first story, you should also note there's an almost absolute overlay between the level of secularity and the political affiliation of those various regions. But our ultimate concern must be reaching the persons in all of these communities with the gospel of Jesus Christ. As we think about our challenge as gospel-minded Christians looking to the future, well, it's very clarifying to understand that increasingly we're going to be facing people who have not so much heard the gospel and rejected it or not responded to it. We're going to be increasingly talking to people who've never heard the gospel before. Next, in trying to understand the culture around us, I want to refer to a story that ran Sunday in the New York Times, a headline story in the Style edition. Here's the headline, An Anxious Nation. The subhead, to doctors, it's a medical condition, but anxiety is starting to seem like a sociological one, too. Alex Williams writes, this past winter, Sarah Fader, a 37-year-old social media consultant in Brooklyn who has generalized anxiety disorder, texted a friend in Oregon about an impending visit, and when a quick response failed to materialize, she posted on Twitter to her 16,000-plus followers, I don't hear from my friend for a day. My thought, they don't want to be my friend anymore. And she added the hashtag, this is what anxiety feels like. Now, if that sounds extreme, well, just hold on for the rest of the story. As Williams writes, thousands of people were soon offering up their own examples under the hashtag. Some were retweeted more than 1,000 times. You might say, Ms. Fader struck a nerve, quote, if you're a human being living in 2017 and you're not anxious, there's something wrong with you, end quote. What's going on here? Well, some have argued, going back to the beginnings of what we call the modern age, that with the modern age comes anxiety. To be modern is to be anxious. It was the poet W.H. Auden who 70 years ago described the modern age as the age of anxiety, and the poet put his poetic finger on something that most people do recognize as real. There is an anxiety in the modern age. Furthermore, it's an anxiety that is now generalized where it hadn't been expressed before. The anxiety of which the poet was speaking about was the anxiety experienced by the elites who supposedly were on the cutting edge of modernity and they were likely to be the most anxious. But now anxiety seems to be driven through the entire culture. People at every dimension of the culture seem to be marked by anxiety. This is perhaps driven through the culture by Hollywood and entertainment, as well as the psychotherapeutic industry that continues to profit by telling us just how anxious we are. The New York Times article begins by reminding us that for psychiatrists, anxiety is actually a diagnosable syndrome and illness. The person who's identified here in the beginning of the article has what's defined and diagnosed as, quote, generalized anxiety disorder, end quote. Of course, the poet Odin would tell us that's just about everyone. In this sense, we are all anxious. Anxiety, as a matter of fact, and its disorders are being diagnosed to an increased number of young persons. As the Times article says, quote, according to data from the National Institutes of Mental Health, some 38% of girls aged 13 to 17 and 26% of boys have anxiety disorder. On college campuses, anxiety is running well ahead of depression as the most common mental health concern, according to a 2016 national study of more than 150,000 college students. Meanwhile, the Times tells us, the number of web searches involving the term has nearly doubled over the last 5 years, according to Google Trends. One of the points made in the Times analysis is that the rise of social media has magnified and multiplied the opportunities to be anxious. Remember that story that began the article in which a woman decided that someone really didn't want to be her friend if they didn't respond in social media within 24 hours, thus leading to even greater anxiety. Christians need to wonder if all of this can really be so modern as it appears, because when you think about the scripture, we come to understand that human nature really hasn't changed, even though we might be using new labels to diagnose the problems that come with the human condition. The reality is that it's biblically defined in ways that are very consistent over time. It's easy to say we can find anxious people in the Bible, and we certainly find anxiety dealt with in terms of the experience that is recorded in Scripture. In John 14, verse 1, Jesus, speaking to his disciples, says, "Let not your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." We should simply also insert here that if so many of our children, teenagers, and young adults are anxious, perhaps at least a part of that is because we are failing as parents to protect them from the very sources of that anxiety, or to ground them in such a way that they would not be, like so many of their peers, so increasingly anxious. And even historians can step in to say, maybe this problem isn't so modern as it appears. Scott Stossel is the editor at The Atlantic. He is also the author of the book My Age of Anxiety. As the New York Times says, that book helped kick off the anxiety memoir boom 3 years ago. Well, if you missed that boom, don't miss this quote from Stossel. He said, quote, "Every generation, going back to Pericles Greece, to second century Rome, to the Enlightenment, to the Georgians, and to the Victorians, believes itself to be the most anxious age ever," end quote. Every age, though, does have its distinctive way of making its spiritual hunger and need for Christ most evident. Maybe that's what we're seeing here, that the way this society is making that need so clear is by the skyrocketing rates of anxiousness and even anxiety about anxiety. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/albertmohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'm speaking to you from Phoenix, Arizona, and I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.